coming up on Star Stuff. An old formula revised to help find new planets. Will the spacecraft of the future be printed rather than built? And Australia pays $707 million for the construction and launch of a new state-of-the-art US Air Force military satellite. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A centuries-old idea of how planetary orbits are spaced in relation to the Sun is proving remarkably accurate in predicting the locations of planets orbiting other stars. The research reported in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society found planets orbiting other stars obey a mathematical ratio formula known as the Titus-Bode relation even more closely than planets in our own solar system. According to the study's lead author, Tim Bouvier from the Australian National University, the Titus-Bode relation has already detected about half a dozen new planets. The results mean astronomers can now predict where planets should be located. The Titus-Bode relation, more commonly referred to simply as Bode's law, was first developed in the 1700s to explain the ratio in the distances between the planets in the solar system between Mercury and Saturn. Put in its simplest term, Bode's law states that from one planet to the next, the orbital distance from the Sun increases by a factor of between 1.4 and 2. However, there was one glaring exception to this rule, the gap between Mars and Jupiter. That was until the very first night of the 19th century, when astronomers discovered the existence of a dwarf planet known as Ceres in what is now the main asteroid belt. With this discovery, Bode's law seemed complete. However, as planets were found further out beyond Saturn in our solar system, another problem developed. Bode's law fails to predict the location of a planet at the orbit of Neptune. And this was a death knell for the relation, which was eventually dismissed by modern-day astronomers as just a meaningless coincidence. That was until Bouvier and his supervising professor Dr. Charlie Lineweaver redesigned the equation, making it more generalized rather than specific to our solar system. You see, the original Titus-Bode relation had an extra variable in it to account for the closeness of the orbits of Earth and Venus in comparison to the other planets. Bouvier and Lineweaver removed that extra variable. They then applied the equation to several planetary systems orbiting other stars and were surprised to find that 90 to 95% of those planetary systems adhered to Bode's law to a far greater extent than planets in our own solar system. According to the authors, the main difference is that the exoplanetary systems they're detecting are extremely compact, whereas our own solar system is fairly stretched out in comparison. Bouvier says he's finding that the more compact a system is, the more it obeys the Titus-Bode relation.
Well, it all started in 1787, and these two guys, Titus and Bode, came up with this relation which predicted where the location of the planets in our own solar system.
They looked at our planet, the planets in our solar system, and they noticed there was a ratio there, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. And they noticed that this ratio seemed to be semi-consistent between all the planets, and it was all going good until Neptune was discovered, and then people gave this law less regard. But nevertheless, before the whole Neptune debacle, they were still able to predict the asteroid belt. That was in 1801.
Hmm. And that was the clincher, wasn't it? Predicting the asteroid belt where there wasn't a planet, but there could have been, seemed to be the clincher.
That's what got everyone interested and maybe had a better look at it. And so we were curious if we could find something in our solar system with this. Maybe this could help us find extrasolar planets which haven't been found yet. And so the very first thing we did was redesign the law. Other people have been using a different version of it because the one that was used back in the 1700s, this was catered specifically for our solar system. And our solar system has a couple of intricate things about it, like the distance between Earth and Venus seems to be a little close compared to the other ones. And so if you were to apply this law to extrasolar planets, you sort of get all the little details about our solar system feeding into extrasolar planets, which isn't really a good idea. You want to start with the most general thing as possible. And that's what we started with, a more basic law. And the first thing we did was to find out whether this law applies to extrasolar planets more or less than our solar system. And the tricky thing about this is figuring out in which systems all the planets have been detected and which ones planets are likely to be missing. This is just based on the detection sensitivity and the characteristics of the planets. And after isolating the systems where we think, okay, there's not going to be any more planet detections in the system, we apply our TB relation to those systems, and we find that actually the majority of planetary systems adhere to the TB relation to a much greater extent than the solar system does, something like 95-96%. The first thing we find is that our solar system, even though a planet was discovered using this relation, it doesn't actually obey the relation very well compared to other systems.
Could that be because of the planetary migration, you know, looking at the Nice model for our solar system?
Yeah, we're not 100% sure of the reason. That's one potential one, but we think the main difference is the extrasolar planet systems that we're detecting are really compact, whereas our solar system is stretched out in comparison. The main thing is Mercury, being the innermost planet, has a period of 90 days, whereas we're looking at planetary systems where they have four or five planets and they all have periods less than 50 days.
A lot of that could be, too, because of the way these planets are detected, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right, because that's really, if we're looking at four, five, six planet systems, then we're really only going to find the ones that are compact like that.
Because when you look at the systems through the wobble method, then the planets which are most likely to cause a wobble in their host star are likely to be closer to the star and larger, of course. And when you look at it using a transit method like Kepler, you've got a situation where you're limited to the planets whose orbits directly cross in front of their star as viewed from Earth.
Yeah, exactly right. And the majority of our systems are, I think, maybe 60 out of 68 are from Kepler. And Kepler in general, for the most part, quiet that the planet transits at least three times. So really, they only detect planets with periods less than, say, 70 days.
Yeah, that's right. They're not looking for planets further out because they want to get those three transits, one transit per year, meaning they're specifically looking for planets in habitable zones around sun-like stars.
Yeah.
I guess for you guys now, the position is what you wait and see which systems don't follow the TB rule, turn out to follow the TB rule when more data becomes available?
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually been the case for one system where in April, I think, we made a prediction, and then in June, Kepler released a new data update, and it included one of the planets that we predicted. That was KOI 2722.
And what does this tell us about planetary formation? The TB law is correct, then that must tell us something about how planets form in disks around protostars.
Yeah, exactly, because you would imagine if things like migration and scattering are common events, that you would expect that this wouldn't be prevalent throughout all systems, that some would be off if a hot Jupiter had migrated inwards. But what we're finding is the more compact that a system is, the more that it obeys this relation. From our investigations, we think this has something to do with resonances between planets in a system. That's orbital resonances, so a 2-to-1 resonance, 3-to-1 resonance in their orbital period.
Now, when you talk about resonance, we're talking here about a gravitational kick an inner planet might give an outer planet, aren't we?
Yeah, that's correct. If two planets in a system, one might have an orbital period of 50 days, and a second one could have an orbital period close to 100 days, and we would call that a 2-to-1 resonance based on their orbital period. And this locks the planets in a certain configuration, and it can play a part on a whole range of the planet's characteristics, but for the most part, it has a stabilizing effect on these two planets, and it locks them in their current positions. Somewhat surprisingly, we find that extraplanetary systems obey the T relation much more than our solar system does, and we can use this to make predictions largely in Kepler systems, where we believe that planets haven't been found yet, and we can give the location of the planets, so their orbital period, and we can also say the maximum radius of those planets based on their current non-detection. So we can say if a planet was here, it would have already been detected if it was this size based on the sensitivity to Kepler, which is quite nice because then we can also say we isolate one system, it's in the habitable zone with a maximum radius of 2.5 Earth radii. 2.5 or somewhere around 2.3, 2.4 is sort of the transition zone between rocky and gas planets.
That's Tim Boviet, an astronomer with the Australian National University. The religious writings of ancient Egyptian scribes have been used by modern-day scientists to accurately determine tiny changes in the orbits of a distant star. The study, reported in the Astrophysical Journal, found a papyrus document known as the Cairo Calendar, which was written more than 3 millennia ago, accurately recorded regular changes in the brightness of a star system known as Algol every 2.850 days. The researchers, including lead author Dr. Lauri Jetsu of the University of Helsinki, report that this closely matches the 2.867-day change in brightness exhibited by the same system since its rediscovery in 1783, some 3,000 years later. The Cairo calendar may well be the oldest preserved historical document of the discovery of a variable star. Algol is actually a triple star system. It's located 93 light-years away in the constellation Perseus. Two of the stars in the system are called eclipsing binaries because they closely orbit each other and pass in front of one another as seen from Earth. The eclipse, as one star blocks out some of the light coming from the other star during its orbit, causes a regular and sudden drop in brightness, giving the system its name Algol, which translates into the winking demon's head. Jetsu and colleagues describe how the ancient Egyptian year was very similar to our own, with 365 days spread over 12 months of 30 days each. However, each ancient Egyptian month consisted of 3 weeks of 10 days each, and the days were usually divided into three periods corresponding to morning, midday, and afternoons, which may also have included night. The Cairo calendar gives predictions of good and bad occurrences during each of these three daily periods, except for the 5 additional days of the year which are outside the monthly calendar. The authors discovered several cycles occurring throughout the calendar each year, including one which corresponds to the lunar cycle and another of precisely 2.850 days, closely matching the 2.867-day change in the brightness of Algol. According to Jetsu and colleagues, the minute difference in duration is caused by changes in the motion of the Algol system over the intervening 3,000 years. The stars orbit each other so closely, the gravity of one star is pulling gas off the other star, increasing the time between dips in brightness. The problem is, however, observations over the last 2 centuries have failed to show any clear pattern, and that's puzzled astronomers. According to Jetsu and colleagues, the increase in duration only becomes apparent over much longer timescales of thousands of years, and that's where the Cairo calendar comes in. University of New South Wales cultural astronomer Dr. Duane Hummacher says it's an innovative form of research.
The authors have clearly taken an unconventional method by looking at old astronomical records kept from 2,000 or 3,000 years ago and applied them to modern astronomical observations. It's a really good way of showing how ancient texts can really be used for contemporary science. It's not just relegated to myth and legend. So it's really quite interesting what they've done. I mean, Algol is a very special binary star anyway. This is something that's been known in Greek mythology as one of the eyes of Medusa in the sky. And it's seen, sort of seen as the winking eye. It's also called the demon star.
The winking demon's head, I think, is the Arabic translation.
Correct, yeah. So the difference in brightness is a factor of 3 between when it's its brightest and when it's its faintest because of this these binary dips. So it's really interesting. I mean, this is fantastic. They seem to have brought the confirmed date of this object being observed back by quite a long ways. I mean, of course, like any scholarship, there are going to be, some arguments and debates against it, and they'll have to hash that out. But this is a really great approach to doing this.
Surely there are a lot of star systems out there that there are a lot of eclipsing binaries that would have similar periods.
There are a lot of eclipsing binaries with periods in that range, but the thing about Algol is it's one of the brightest binary stars, variable stars like this that we know of, and it's quite significant. So I think they've really taken an innovative step here in trying to use these old records and really put in some rigorous research into it.
That's Dr. Duane Hummacher, a University of New South Wales cultural astronomer. Well, the idea of catching a magic carpet ride to the stars may not be as far-fetched as it sounds. Picture this, a fleet of flat, inexpensive spacecraft, each the size and shape of a small rug, which could soon be floating down onto the surface of alien worlds. At least, that's what could happen if a new proposal by NASA gets its wings. The two-dimensional planetary surface landers, or the 2D project as it's called, is one of 12 ideas selected to receive initial seed funding under the American Space Agency's NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts Program, or NIAC. The proposals were picked because of their potential to transform future missions, provide new capabilities, or improve current approaches. The two-dimensional landers would be like flying carpets with flat and flexible electronics printed on both sides. The project's principal investigator, Dr. Hamid Hamati from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, says it's an entirely new approach.
Right now, what is landed on, let's say, Mars, it's the size of a small car to a size of a large car, and it has a number of science instruments on it that has capability to move around. These happen to be fairly expensive instruments, and one gets only one shot at landing. If the landing doesn't go well, then it will be at a great expense. And also, since the landing at interesting sites is difficult, that is, some of the more geological interesting places are also more hazardous to land. So as a result, mission managers would be reluctant to go to places like that because they're highly risky. So this approach is, you can look at it as like a flying carpet. It's the size of, a carpet or a blanket. With the technology that's available today, everything is very low profile and it will be on both sides. So the solar panels are flat anyway, but they would be flexible. The batteries would be flexible. All the science instruments would be flexible. This is a technology that has now become available. And for example, the smartphones and the ultra-small notebooks and the laptops are using this flexible electronics technology. It's also possible to have various instruments, such as it's called the laboratory on a chip. So you could have laboratories, which are science instruments that are basically, very low profile or flat. So the idea is to put on both sides of this large sheet as many science instruments as you can. Some of them, they don't exist now. They have to be developed, but the way the technology of...
Moore's Law and that?
Yes, exactly. The technology is progressing at exponential rate. That means in 10 years, a factor of 1,000 improvement, and in 20 years, a factor of 1,000,000 improvement. So huge changes are coming. So the idea is to take advantage of that and not to have large instruments sent there. So this way, when it's a low profile, it's like a sheet, then you can send a stack of them, let's say 50 of them or 100 of them. We don't know. We have to build these to see what they turn out to be. And that way you can just drop them on planets, on asteroids, or whatever bodies that they can land on or have some kind of a rendezvous with, because if it has a low gravity, it's a small body, it basically will be hovering around it, rendezvousing with it rather than landing on it. And it gives you the opportunity that, even if you lose some of them and some of them make it, then you're still fine. It's not a very risky endeavor. And you could send various types of instruments there. So the stack could be, some of them, could have different type of instruments on it. It's a futuristic idea. We haven't worked all the details, whether it will really work as we currently envision it. It remains to be seen. These are just landers. It doesn't have a rover capability, but they can think of ways that in the future, some wheels will come off of it and start moving around also.
And so what happens now? You're refining the idea, I take it, that's where you're at?
We'll be looking at, primarily in the beginning, at architectures and figuring out what's possible, what is not possible, taking a few different missions. Let's say we want to land on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter. We want to land on Mars and a few other scenarios. Each scenario will have different requirements in terms of landing. How do we deliver these sheets to the surface so that they survive, they don't tear apart and survive the temperature of the environment and radiation and all that. There are a number of things to be worked out. One is delivery, one is what kind of instruments one can have on them, and overall what kind of capability they will have, what missions they're suitable to certain missions and not some other missions. So it's more architecture and technology definition. And then if you're successful, we may get a phase two, and that would be delving more deep into it and expanding it to the point that it becomes ready for fabrication and fabricating some and see how well they work.
That's Dr. Hamid Hamati from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. A Delta IV rocket carrying a new $707 million military telecommunications satellite paid for by Australia has blasted into orbit from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida.
Minus 30.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Go WGS.
Minus
Greenboard.
25.
Flight lock in.
SRM TVC blowdown.
Minus 15.
Arpingditer. Rough ignition.
T-minus
10. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have ignition of the RS-68 main engine. 2, 1. And we have liftoff of the Delta IV launch vehicle carrying the WGS-6 satellite for the United States Air Force. The wideband global SATCOM satellite provides significantly increased capacity for our nation's leaders, warfighters, and international partners.
Recovering from the initial launch transients as we're passing 25 seconds. Mark, 25 seconds in. Still looking
you
good.
Are hearing the voice of Steve Agud providing launch vehicle ascent data.
Altitude passing 2.5 miles, 36 seconds. Mach 1 vehicle now going transonic. Chamber pressure is beginning to drop on the four solid rocket motors as expected. Good symmetrical burns. Max Q. Maximum dynamic pressure in the vehicle as we're approaching the 1 minute mark. Altitude now 7.7 nautical miles. Velocity 2,998 feet per second. 5 miles downrange. Chamber pressure holding solid in the first stage. Second stage systems coming online. The hydrazine supply valve is now open in the vehicle. Standing by for solid rocket motor burnout just a few seconds from now. And we have burnout. Standing by for separation. Deprivation of the solid rocket boosters. The Delta vehicle now only weighs one half of what it did at launch some 2 minutes ago. Spilling propellant at the rate of 1,850 pounds per second.
The $707 million cost of the satellite and launch was the price Australia was willing to pay to access the United States military's new state-of-the-art WGS, or Wideband Global SATCOM, constellation of telecommunications satellites. The latest bird is the sixth in the constellation and the first to be paid for by another country. The WGS network is used to relay all kinds of military broadcasts, from video conferences through to satellite imagery and other high-bandwidth data. It not only provides communications between ships, aircraft and ground forces, but also lead command and operations centers, the US Department of State, the White House and a selected group of close allied nations, including Australia. The new constellation provides impressive operational flexibility, allowing, for example, Navy ships operating in X-band radio frequencies to communicate with aircraft or ground forces which may be using Ka-band, or vice versa. It's the satellite itself which does the conversion automatically, allowing crosstalk between different branches of the military and differing capabilities. In what's an unusual partnering arrangement for the US Air Force, Australia paid for Boeing to build the satellite and for the United Launch Alliance, a partnership of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, to put the satellite into orbit. Australia's TAB also covers some of the operational expenses. Now, in exchange for all that, Australia gets access rights to the WGS network. Washington also has a similar agreement in the offing with other close allies, Canada, Denmark, Luxembourg, the Netherlands and New Zealand. Those five nations will be banding together to pay for the ninth WGS satellite when it's launched. The latest launch came just 3 months after the fifth WGS satellite reached orbit. The first spacecraft in the constellation WGS-1 was launched back in October 2007, followed by WGS-2 and 3 in 2009. Those satellites, all designated Block 1, cost a combined $800 million. The first of the larger, more powerful Block 2 satellites, WGS-4, was launched in January 2012. It and WGS-5 and 6 cost a combined $1.2 billion. The next group of four satellites now in production will cost an additional $1.6 billion, eventually providing a 10-satellite constellation. Meanwhile, an Atlas V rocket has blasted into orbit from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station carrying a MUSOS military communications satellite.
This is Atlas Mission Control at T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We have main engine start. We have ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket carrying the second Mobile User Objective System mission for the United States Navy. MUO significantly enhances communications for U.S. forces on the move. You'll be hearing the voice of Matt Donovan providing launch vehicle.
And we are in
data.
The zero angle.
Let's
of
listen in for mission
flight.
Progress.
The booster roll program has been completed. We've hit Mach 1. Now going through the region of maximum dynamic pressure. The vehicle is throttling back up at this point. Engine performance continues to look good. Booster has gone closed loop. And we've now throttled back down in preparation for SRB burnout. And we have SRB burnout. Looks good. The vehicle is continuing nominally. And we are now throttling back up to our 2.5G segment. We have SRB jettison. Good indications of jettison on the first two and the next three SRBs. Q-alpha steering is now enabled.
The 63-meter-tall Lockheed Martin and Boeing-built rocket was carrying the second United States Navy MUSOS network satellite designed to replace the military's previous 2.4-kilobyte voice-only UHF satellite network. The Lockheed Martin-built MUSOS satellites provide 340 kilobytes per second with both voice and data transmission capabilities. Weighing in at 6,804 kilograms, MUSOS satellites are the heaviest payloads to have flown aboard the Atlas V, which had to be outfitted with five strap-on solid rocket boosters in order to lift the payload into orbit. The MUSOS constellation will eventually include five satellites and is intended to bring 3G cellular technology to ships, submarines, aircraft, land vehicles, and troops in the field. The first MUSOS satellite was launched in 2012. MUSOS 3 is targeted to launch in 2014, followed by MUSOS 4 in 2015, and the final satellite in the constellation MUSOS 5 sometime after that. And finally this week, it's been revealed Iran has constructed a new secret rocket launching facility, which could be used for testing intercontinental ballistic missiles. The new launch complex was discovered 40 kilometres southeast of Shahrud, about 350 kilometres east of Tehran near the Caspian Sea and the Turkmenistan border. Satellite imagery, analysed by the highly respected Jane's Intelligence Review, showed extensive construction over a three-year period, including a launch pad, vehicle assembly complex, storage facilities, an administration block, a launch tower, and roads leading to a mysterious underground complex. Tehran has pursued ambitious goals to develop a space program, finally successfully launching a live monkey into space after previous attempts failed. Western governments fear Tehran's space program is actually a cover to develop a ballistic missile capability to enable it to launch atomic warheads, which they suspect Tehran is seeking to develop under the cover of its civilian nuclear power program. You see, long-range ballistic missiles used to propel Iranian satellites into orbit can just as easily deliver thermonuclear warheads onto populated centres. Jane says the new Shahrud site is one of three launch facilities designed to serve Iran's booming ballistic missile program. Iranian officials were not immediately available for comment following the discovery. However, the oil-rich nation has repeatedly insisted in the past that its massive nuclear program is designed for peaceful power generation only. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.